Well, this time we look for the picture of God in the book of Proverbs. It says right in the first verse, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. But apparently he didn't write them all. He collected them. You may recall earlier in 1 Kings chapter 4, there's mention about him collecting Proverbs. 1 Kings 4, around 29. See if yours reads anything like my... I'm using the New Revised Standard again. It says, God gave Solomon very great wisdom, discernment, and breadth of understanding, as vast as the sand on the seashore. So that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else. And it named some people. He was wiser than. His fame spread throughout all the surrounding nations. He composed 3,000 proverbs. And his songs numbered 1,005. We don't have his hymn book. He would speak of trees, from the cedar that is in the Lebanon, to the hyssop that grows in the wall. He would speak of animals and birds and reptiles and fish. People came from all the nations to hear the wisdom of Solomon. They came from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. There's also a mention in the book Ecclesiastes, which is the one for next time. In Ecclesiastes, the very last chapter, Ecclesiastes 12, and it's mentioned in 9 and 10, besides being wise, the teacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs. The teacher sought to find pleasing words, and he wrote words of truth plainly. Now, other than these wise proverbs collected here in the book called Proverbs, that's in the traditional canon of the 66, in the Apocrypha, those extra books we've mentioned before and will much later when we come to the period between Malachi and Matthew, there's another book called The Wisdom of Solomon, and there's a book called Ecclesiasticus. Not Ecclesiastes, that's the one in the canon that we do next time, but Ecclesiasticus, and we'll look at that a little later. Now, why would such a collection be in the middle of the 66? There's no ritual, no ceremony, apparently no theology, no Ten Commandments. So what does this contribute to our picture of God and add to our basis for trusting him? Let me suggest just a couple of things before we share these together. In the first place, seems apparent to me, with the Proverbs right almost dead center, if you look at the back, split your Bible open, it's almost right in the middle, the book of Proverbs. Right in the middle of the Bible with all its theology and all its ritual and ceremony and history of wars and rumors of wars and so on, there's a very practical book on how to live a sensible, responsible life, which suggests to me that the religion God desires is related to real life and is very practical and very useful. It's not just creed and ceremony. Although that's mentioned later on, you remember in James, there's a definition of genuine religion, James 1:26, right after Hebrews, James 1:26. If any think they are religious and do not bridle their tongues but deceive their hearts, their religion is worthless. Now there follows a definition of genuine religion. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to care for orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Which is rather practical, isn't it? Is that leaving theology out? Or does it mean that a truly religious person, that is one who knows and admires God, is wise and disciplined and industrious? In fact, he's just plain a useful person, a good neighbor. And sometimes I like to say that God is not so concerned about theology as he is about the neighborhood. Of course, if you want a neighborhood of good people, we tend to become like the God we worship and admire, so we're not likely to have a good neighborhood without a true picture of God. So the two do go together. But if all our theological discussion does not make us good neighbors, then it hasn't done a great deal of good. Then a second suggestion to keep in mind as we go through, how could Solomon be so wise, particularly on the subjects mentioned, and yet make such a fool of himself? Why would God give him such wisdom if he knew he would so dismally fail to live up to it? Although we've seen that happen before, you remember he gave Samson great strength, and look how he abused it. Did God's gift of wisdom take away Solomon's freedom to make a fool of himself? Now that really is saying something about God. And some may have the feeling if they've been greatly blessed for many years, that guarantees the outcome. No, you still could make a fool out of yourself and turn into a rebel. Think of all the years Lucifer was a brilliant representative of God and the truth about God, and then became the deceiver and his worst enemy. We will always remain free. Do you think we'll remain free for eternity? Mm-hmm. Well, that's something to think about. There are many famous proverbs that almost become key texts, as some call them. For example, in 3:11, "My child, do not despise the Lord's discipline or be weary of his reproof. For the Lord reproves the one he loves as a father the son in whom he delights." And you know, in a much longer form, that turns up in the book of Hebrews and other places in the Bible. And another one I've heard all my life, 9:10, for example, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Usually stops right there, but it goes on. "And the knowledge of the Holy One is insight," which reminds us of the parallelism I think we've discussed before, and we will later, that in Hebrew literary form, the second line may seem to repeat or illustrate or confirm the thought of the first line. So what's matched with the fear of the Lord? The knowledge of the Holy One. This hardly could mean the terror of the Lord. It would hardly match with the knowledge of the Holy One. And since we know from elsewhere that knowledge in the Bible can have the meaning of respect and reverence, that sheds meaning on the word fear here. And so do you in your version maybe not even have the word fear? What do you have maybe in the Good News Bible?
"To be wise, you must first have reverence."
Reverence, you see. "Happy is the man who fears the Lord," the King James used to say, and that's the literal translation. But "happy is the man who's scared stiff of God" makes no sense at all. But reverence for God is the beginning of learning, and "happy is the man who's ready to listen to God and to learn." And because you remember 1 John 4 says that the man who's afraid of God doesn't even know him. The man who's afraid is worried about being punished. He doesn't really know God. You remember over there in 1 John 4. And there'll be more for that later. Now, you notice in the Good News Bible, they choose reverence rather than fear. My New Revised Standard, you see, is more literal and is more directly in the line of the King James on down. The Good News Bible is a very colorful interpretation. And I was looking at the Proverbs also in the Good News and how colorful it is and how very insightful. Like the 28th chapter, I just happened to let my eye drop on and start reading. "The wicked run when no one is chasing them, but an honest person is as brave as a lion. When a nation sins, it will have one ruler after another, but a nation will be strong and endure when it has intelligent, sensible leaders." I suppose this hasn't come up in Congress for discussion. "A man in authority who oppresses poor people is like a driving rain that destroys the crops." I think the politicians would find this very fruitful source for their orations before the House. "If you have no regard for the law, you are on the side of the wicked. But if you obey it, you are against them. Evil people do not know what justice is, but those who worship the Lord understand it well. Better to be poor and honest than rich and dishonest. A young man who obeys the law is intelligent. One who makes friends with good-for-nothings is a disgrace to his father. If you get rich by charging interest and taking advantage of people, your wealth will go to someone who is kind to the poor. If you do not obey the law, God will find your prayers too hateful to hear. If you trick an honest person into doing evil, you will fall into your own trap. The innocent will be well rewarded. Rich people always think they are wise, but a poor person who has insight into character knows better. When good men come to power, everybody celebrates. But when bad men rule, people stay in hiding. You will never succeed in life if you try to hide your sins, confess them and give them up, then God will show mercy to you, and so on down. I mean, it's one of every single proverb is worth consideration. It's such good sense. I was wondering here at the beginning, Dana, you first. Is there any one of the proverbs that your parents have used for you through the years, perhaps?
Well,
in your house?
There's probably some of them that they have used, you know, time to time, but they didn't say, "Now, dear, this rule comes out of Proverbs, so you better listen up." And, I mean,
would that have added authority? Or?
A lot of these are good suggestions, and I'll bet they used most of them when I was growing up.
Of course, maybe they just said it because it made sense. And it's also in the Proverbs, because the Proverbs make sense. Makes no difference. Do you remember one that they might have used on you? Are there some Proverbs that sound as if they're in the Bible, but they really aren't?
A gentle answer quiets anger, but a harsh one sets it up.
Were you ever told that by your parents?
Yes.
Once in a while. Did your folks ever tell you, spare the rod and spoil the child? Is that in the Proverbs?
I wouldn't think so.
Not quite. So we need to look that up in a minute. It doesn't quite say that. How about a stitch in time saves nine? So when you tear your clothes, please bring it to your mother at once so she can stitch it up before it rips all the way. If a button begins to come off, don't wait till it falls off. Come on in and let her sew it up, because a stitch in time saves nine. Is that in the Proverbs?
Well, it doesn't seem like it would be.
No. So some things came from Shakespeare rather than Solomon and other people that we don't know about. But whenever we say something that's pithy and makes good sense, we think, it could be in the Proverbs. Because that is the nature of them, isn't it? Did you grow up with any Proverbs, Janie?
Oh, probably, like Dana was talking.
Common sense statements,
right.
And whether they were in the book or not.
Right.
Well, what did you think of the Proverbs about women?
I loved 31, second half, but I'm sure glad Bob never quoted 27:15.
Well, so that we will appreciate 31, should we read the bad ones first and then come to 31 on the end?
I'm not fond of
31, I think,
15.
Describes you as I know you. Like, add to my collection here. I've jotted some down. Look at 19:13. So this can cover Dana and Connie. A stupid child is ruin to a father, and a wife's quarreling is a continual dripping of rain. Now, if you had heard that, and you didn't know it was in the Proverbs, would you feel, that does sound like something from Solomon? Well, look at some others. Look at 21, verse 9. It is better to live in a corner of the housetop than in a house shared with a contentious wife. And then over in 19, again, it's repeated. It is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and fretful wife. It seems to be very much on Solomon's mind. Of course, according to the record, how many wives did he have?
Thousands.
Can you imagine if several of them were being contentious and fretful? He could wish he was in the desert somewhere. Well, look at a few others here. Look at 25:24. Well, there it is again. See, he was troubled with this, wasn't he? A great deal. Look at 11:22. I've jotted down about wives. 11:22. Like a gold ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without good sense. And they used to wear rings in the noses those days, you remember? And so he may have seen some of his 1,000 wives with rings in their snouts, and they were not making good sense. And I'm sure they were beautiful, or they wouldn't have qualified for membership in his harem. Do we have any more like that? 27, 15, and 16? Which is the one you didn't want?
27:15.
Okay, 27. It's in both of our collections. A continual dripping on a rainy day and a contentious wife are alike. To restrain her is to restrain the wind. or to grasp oil in the right hand. But then I also have 18:22, which says, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord." I wonder how many of the ladies he had in his collection were like that. Now, over in Ecclesiastes, there's even something on this. That's in the next book. In Ecclesiastes 7:27, I have in mind, well, you have to read the whole section. He's looking for a person that can be trusted. He says in verse 26, "I found more bitter than death the woman who is a trap, whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. One who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. See, this is what I found," says the teacher, adding one thing to another to find the sum, "which my mind has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among 1,000 I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God made human beings straightforward, but they have devised many schemes." So what is it he's looking for but he couldn't find? Well, look at 20 verse 6 in Proverbs. 20 verse 6. He says, "Many proclaim themselves loyal, but who can find one worthy of trust?" And apparently he could find one man among 1,000, but he could never find a woman he could trust. So it pays to read the whole thing, doesn't it, and come to 31. Are there any more bad ones in your list? Mm-mm. There are in the apocryphal books, by the way, in the Wisdom of Sirach, called the Wisdom of Solomon. There are several comments about the ladies. "Like a sandy climb to an old man's feet is a talkative wife to a quiet man." And I have to remember, that's in the Apocrypha, that's not in the canonical book, but it's quite appealing. How about this one? "Sin began with a woman, and because of her we all die." It would seem that Luther had read that, because that's his argument in the book of Genesis. He says, because of woman's weakness, we are in trouble. Luther even says in his commentary on Genesis that if only Adam had gone first to the tree, humans would not have been deceived. He would have just denounced the devil as a liar and resisted his temptation. But Eve being weak collapsed. That was Luther.
Did he discuss the aspect that Adam readily took it from her? Where was his strength then?
He didn't say too much about that. So Paul was more of a gentleman about that. Oh, I have things here like to have a daughter is a disadvantage. This is not in the Bible now. This is not in the Bible. This is in it is in Roman Catholic Bibles if they contain the Apocrypha as part of it. And there are other very wise things. A fool raises his voice when he laughs, but a shrewd man will hardly even smile quietly. I enjoy the apocryphal books of wisdom. The man who teaches a fool is gluing a potsherd together, or rousing a sleeper out of a deep sleep. The man who lectures to a fool lectures to one who is dozing, and at the conclusion he will say, "What was it?" I've used that in class for many years, but I remind the students that it's right out of the Apocrypha, not in the traditional canon. But now we come to 31, and it isn't fair to read all the other things Solomon included without reading 31. Starting, say, with verse 10. "A capable wife who can find." See, there he is again saying, I've been looking. Someone I can trust, someone who's capable. "She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from far away. She rises while it is still night, and provides food for her household and tasks for her servant girls." Do notice she does have servants. "She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard." Note the authority she has. And if you think that the ladies back in those days did not have much authority, read what Rabbi Heschel has to say on the subject. The women were greatly respected and given much responsibility and freedom in those days, more than appears. "She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable, and having got up a great while before it is day," it then says, "her lamp does not go out at night." The poor lady gets no sleep. "She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid for her household when it snows, for all her household are clothed in crimson. She makes herself coverings. This lady makes the fabric, she makes the clothes, she plants the fields, she does all the business, and we wait to see what her husband might be doing. But it goes on to say her clothing is fine linen and purple. Oh, here it is. Her husband is known in the city gates, taking his seat among the elders of the land. Now, the New Revised Standard has tried to clear this up a bit, because in the King James it just says sitting, which seems like loafing, relaxing, you know, while his wife works. Taking his seat sounds a little more as if he's doing something. Do you remember in the book of Ruth, when Boaz had to settle the matter of the lineage of Ruth, and that somebody else had first option on this widow? Where did he go to do this important business? He went to the gates, because that's where this man would be sitting. So you see, the husband here is not loafing. He's doing very important city business. But the subject is the wife. We men feel it's very important to point that out. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household, and does not eat the bread of idleness. Now, it seems to me it's quite unnecessary to add that, but just to be emphatic. Her children rise up and call her happy. Well, King James, blessed, same thing. Her husband, too, and he praises her. I should think he should. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised, and so on. Now, that needs to be put in there, too, doesn't it? That Solomon would add that as well. Of course, he did suggest that one like this, who can find? See, a capable wife, who can find? He does mention that. But, of course, Solomon didn't write this. Do you notice chapter 31 begins, "The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him"? His mother is saying to King Lemuel, a capable wife who can find, I suggest you look with great care. Just as in the first part, he says, be careful about drinking. Don't drink. As a king, you have important decisions to make. And also, get yourself a capable wife. But it does balance things. In the New Testament, in Luke Acts, and one man, a physician Luke, wrote both the books. Those two books are so respectful toward women and marriage that some of the early Christians were not comfortable. Those who took a rather ascetic view of marriage and women. I'm impressed that Dr. Luke would speak so respectfully of women and of marriage. You notice how Jesus treated women in the other Gospels? How was Paul on the subject of women? Well, we better wait till we get to the writings of Paul to consider that. Now he has a lot to say about loose women in the book, especially chapters 5 and 7. And when you think of his behavior later on, chapters 5 and 7, or especially of the behavior of his father, I wonder if he thought about that when he wrote this. "My child, be attentive to my wisdom, incline your ear to my understanding, so that you may hold on to prudence and your lips may guard knowledge. For the lips of a loose woman drip honey." Do you have loose in yours? 5:3.
"The lips of another man's wife."
The lips of another man's wife, there. Because apparently it does seem adulterous. Later on she says, "My husband is away," doesn't she? So that's fair. Or is that in chapter 7, it's another man's wife? It's good to have several versions around you when you read these. "For the lips of a loose woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps follow the path to Sheol, the grave. She does not keep straight to the path of life. Her ways wander, and she does not know it. And now, my child, listen to me, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house. Or you will give your honor to others, and your years to the merciless, and strangers will take their fill of your wealth, and your labors will go down to the house of an alien. And at the end of your life you will groan when your flesh and body are consumed, and you will say, 'Oh, how I hated discipline, and my heart despised reproof. I did not listen to the voice of my teachers, or incline my ear to my instructors. Now I am at the point of utter ruin in the public assembly.'" In connection with a different subject, did Solomon say such things at the end of his life, leading to the writing of Ecclesiastes and even implied in that book? Well, we come to that next time. Drink water from your own cistern. You can see what that would imply. Flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be for yourself alone and not for sharing with strangers. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Now, these descriptions, and there are more coming up. You might not say to your wife, you're a lovely deer, a graceful doe, and so on, but that was considered highly complimentary at that time. May her breast satisfy you at all times. May you be intoxicated always by her love. Does sound like the Song of Solomon, doesn't it, coming up? Why should you be intoxicated, my son, by another woman, and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? There's a justification for another man's wife. For human ways are under the eyes of the Lord, and he examines all their paths. The iniquities of the wicked ensnare them. They are caught in the toils of their sin. They die for lack of discipline, and because of their great folly, they are lost. It doesn't say they're punished. It sort of rather speaks of consequences, doesn't it? And that's very true again in 7, which is so dramatic. My child, keep my words and store up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teachings as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you're my sister, and call insight your intimate friend, that they may keep you from the loose woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words. And now how dramatic this is. For at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the simple ones, I observed among the youths, a young man without sense, passing along the street near her corner, taking the road to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, at the time of night and darkness. Then a woman comes toward him, decked out like a prostitute, wily of heart. She is loud and wayward, her feet do not stay at home. Now in the street, now in the squares, and at every corner she lies in wait. She seizes him and kisses him, and with impudent face she says to him, I had to offer sacrifices, and today I've paid my vows, so now I've come out to meet you, to seek you eagerly, and I have found you. I have decked my couch with coverings, colored spreads of Egyptian linen. I perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not at home. He is gone on a long journey. He took a bag of money with him. He will not come home until full moon. With much seductive speech she persuades him. With her smooth talk she compels him. Right away he follows her, and goes like an ox to the slaughter, or bounds like a stag toward the trap, until an arrow pierces its entrails. He is like a bird rushing into a snare, not knowing that it will cost him his life. And now, my children, listen to me and be attentive to the words of my mouth. Do not let your hearts turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. For many are those she has laid low, and numerous are her victims. Her house is the way to Sheol, going down to the chambers of death. You notice, once again, it seems to speak of consequence. Yes.
I have a question back in chapter 6, verse 26.
6:26.
It says, a man...
Yes, that's very significant right through that. I'd mark that, too. What's your comment on that?
Well, it's a question. It says, a man can hire a prostitute for the price of a loaf of bread, but adultery will cost him all he has. Is that differentiating? In other words, it's okay to hire a prostitute, and that won't cost him, but like we just read in chapter 7, if it was with a married woman, that's where the problem lies?
I think he's simply saying that to commit adultery with another man's wife is the most devastating. It is more devastating than the other, but he's not recommending it.
I know he's not recommending it. I just wondered if there
were... He's just saying it's more devastating, and you can imagine the ways in which he really is. By the way, that is so good through there, isn't it? Start in 20 of chapter 6. My child, keep your father's commandment and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Bind them upon your heart always. Tie them around your neck, not your finger this time, your neck. And so on. When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk with you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching a light, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life, to preserve you from the wife of another, from the smooth talk of the adulteress. Because he's stressing that, you can see. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, and do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. For a prostitute's fee is only a loaf of bread, but the wife of another stalks a man's very life. I think he's just saying it's worse. What do you think? Now, look, not talking of punishment, but consequence. Can fire be carried in the bosom without burning one's clothes? Or can one walk on hot coals without scorching the feet? So is he who sleeps with his neighbor's wife. No one who touches her will go unpunished. Now, it mentions punishment there. Thieves are not despised who steal only to satisfy their appetite when they are hungry. Yet if they are caught, they will pay sevenfold. They will forfeit all the goods of their house. But he who commits adultery has no sense. Why not? He who does it destroys himself. Not the contrast there? He will get wounds and dishonor, and his disgrace will not be wiped away. For jealousy rouses a husband's fury, there is that too, and he shows no restraint when he takes revenge. He will accept no compensation and refuses a bribe, no matter how great. It does seem as if something's imposed on there in the way of vengeance, but the natural consequence is also greatly mentioned too, isn't it? Of course, the subject of discipline, there's a lot of that in there, isn't there? Like 22:15, we touched one already, here's another one. 22:15, folly is bound up in the heart of a boy, but the rod of discipline drives it far away. Is that spare the rod and spoil the child, Dana? Or is it another one coming up in a minute? Oh, we should have looked back at 3:11. My child, do not despise the Lord's discipline, or beware of his reproof. We touched on that as being in Hebrews as well. But now look at 23:13 and 14. 23:13. Do not withhold discipline from your child. If you beat them with a rod, they will not die. If you beat them with a rod, you will save their lives from Sheol. It's getting a little closer to spare the rod and spoil the child. But look, I don't have these in order. Look at 13:24, and I think this comes the closest. 13:24. Those who spare the rod hate their children, but those who love them are diligent to discipline them. That's pretty close, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's close enough. Spare the rod and spoil the child. They're not exactly the same words. There's a great deal in the Bible about whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and if parents love their children, they will discipline them. But that's very different from what happens in the end. The death at the end, killing people doesn't discipline people, does it? Because discipline means to teach somebody something. Well, look at 22:6 for the good results of discipline and instruction. 22:6, train children in the right way, and when old, they will not stray. How do you understand that? Does that mean if children have strayed, parents have not done a good job?
It means they have freedom.
But it seems to say here, just train children in the right way, and when old, they will not stray. Why doesn't it say, of course, they're free to leave if they want to?
Used to be that if you would look at someone's family, if one or some of the children were not behaving correctly, that the immediate inference was that the parents hadn't done their job.
Yeah. You can hear criticism around the church sometimes about such things.
I was a minister's son, and my father always said, now listen, you have to behave in a certain way because of who you are. People will be looking at you more carefully, and that will reflect on me.
My three daughters even didn't complain of that, but they did point it out from time to time that it was a bit of a burden and responsibility to be my daughters under the circumstances. I'm glad they grew up old enough to choose to want to be that way regardless. But at first, well, can't misrepresent our daddy, which was very kind of them, I thought. Connie, though, on your point, does your version read that same way? The King James, you remember, was train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it.
Teach children how they should live, and they will remember it all their life.
Now, then there'd be no problem there. What about that? Would you rather have the translation like that? Of course, we can't grasp at translations that solve problems but may not be correct. What should we do with that verse? I should have brought my Bible from 26 translations for that one. Do you have any other version in front of you? 22:6. Speaking of different versions, I enjoy the Good News a great deal. It's so colorful, as I showed you a while ago. If you want a really scholarly translation of the Proverbs and the rest of Scripture, though it's not quite finished yet, you want to read what's called the Anchor Bible. I already have some I think it's 45 volumes of this projected translation being produced jointly by Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish scholars. There's never been such a venture in history before. And every line is very carefully translated with voluminous footnotes explaining how it was done. So if you want to see how 22:6 reads in a very scholarly version, I immediately reach behind me and take one of these. Maybe it's almost 50 volumes by now. 22:6. But then I find, oh dear, that's hard to find. They have them sometimes in different orders. Oh, here it is, 22:6. Give a lad the training he needs for life. Even when he is old, it will stay with him. How do you like that? Now, when that's found in the Anchor Bible, you know that the one who did it is inviting the scrutiny of all the best scholars in the world. And he will offer his evidence in support of it. So the translation of the Good News, he will remember it, is rather well supported by this very scholarly translation. Give a lad the training he needs for life. Even when he is old, it will stay with him. But he might rebel against it, but it's there. He will remember it. And have you not heard wonderful stories of youths who've strayed and then later in life have come back?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think what Bob said is a problem, though, because I think that people throughout the ages have said that. They haven't done their job, but they have to remember that the kids are free to do what they want. So I like it better that they remember it. It isn't that they won't ever depart.
Now, if it's true, traditionally, that Solomon wrote these Proverbs when he was young, before he had wasted so much of his life, he would think of this, perhaps, when he too. But he remembered. And in the end of his life, he remembered, and he came back. And he came back so completely, the Lord asked him to write another book in the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes. So this verse really applies to David and Solomon. David could say to Solomon, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he remembered. It'll stay with him. And it stayed with Solomon when, as a tired and foolish old king and his kingdom about to be split asunder, he remembered, and he came back at the last minute. So Solomon himself is a wonderful example of this verse, which is thought by some to be so difficult. Now, using the rest of Scripture, it certainly supports the point you made, Connie, isn't it? We're free. What would be the greatest example in history of God's people being free to go their own way, even though they have been perfectly trained and instructed and disciplined, even in a perfect environment and blessed with perfect health? Lucifer. About Lucifer and the angels. Yeah. They rebelled with him. In church, when you heard families criticized when their children went astray, were any of them criticizing God for letting some of his angels go astray?
No.
It helps to put the two together, doesn't it? So your point about freedom, well, that's the whole point here, that God gave Solomon incredible wisdom and he was free to make a fool of himself. And he knew that when he wrote this. Well, I have lots more on my list. Which ones impressed you most? Did you enjoy most? I like to just sit down and slowly read every one of them and relish each one of them. They're so interesting. But then I stop to think, does it in any way reflect on God, even indirectly, that he would inspire someone to put this kind of advice in the middle of the Bible? Doesn't sound very theological, but religion is supposed to be very practical. I mean, if everybody lived like this, they would be good neighbors, wouldn't they? Unfortunately, religious people don't necessarily make the best neighbors, do they? In fact, in our advertising for my book, Servants or Friends, Another Look at God, we use that at the top of the page each time. Religious people don't necessarily make the best neighbors. But people who would live according to the Proverbs here would make excellent neighbors, wouldn't they? So the ad goes on to say, everything seems to depend on the kind of person we believe our God to be, because we tend to become like the one we worship and admire. I admire God for inspiring this kind of advice in the middle. I like this description of the way he would like us to live. It makes good sense to me. You could trust neighbors like this. But there are some people who are deeply religious, deep into creed and ritual and ceremony, who are downright cruel. in the name of their religion, they're cruel. And so on. Yes.
Was it Ezra that was responsible for putting together in order the Old Testament?
It's a tradition, and of course the orders are not always the same.
And then how about New Testament?
It isn't known. The record seems to show that there was argument about the order and the number of the books in the New Testament for several hundred years. They were still arguing about it. Some collections of the New Testament were without Hebrews, and some were without Revelation. And some had extra books from the New Testament Apocrypha. So we should discuss that more maybe when we were talking about how the Old Testament was closed up. And the decision was made to leave out the books that we call Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. They had to make a decision then. Then later on, they had to make a decision about the books going into the New Testament, because there were many others, apocryphal gospels, epistles, and revelations, claiming inspiration and accepted by some as inspired, especially the gospels that were not very nice to women. And some preferred those to the one written by Luke, because he was so kind to women. So these arguments prevailed. And we have to ask ourselves, how did these 66 come together?
Well, that's what I wondered, is whether God had specifically told someone to put them in the order.
Well, then why would we accept that? You see, we still have to test that, don't we? I think that the Lord would like each one of us to go through and see if we agree. Do you find a coherence, a consistency running through these 66 that is somewhat absent, more or less, from all the many other books that have claimed to belong with these? That's something one would need to read for oneself. And I satisfied myself thoroughly several times by reading them all that are available. Do you find Proverbs very helpful? Do you find yourself disagreeing with any one of them? Even you ladies, the things it says about the ladies.
Knowing, of course, I myself am not like that. So, it's good advice.
It's good advice.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, by the way, when it says a trustworthy woman who can find, we've a trustworthy man who can find, should be in there too. Mm-hmm. Yes.
My favorite, you were asking for favorites. Well, the one I found the most interesting was 1727. I'd always heard the proverb that, you know, people may think you wise, don't open your mouth, and or they may think you're foolish, don't open your mouth and remove all doubt. And I guess it probably originally came from here.
Yes. Isn't it beautifully said? Even fools who keep silent are considered wise. When they close their lips, they are deemed intelligent. We found that to be true. I should ask you what your opinion is of these Psalms, and then turn to 18:2. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing personal opinion. So that wouldn't be fair, would it? What is your opinion of that proverb? 20 verse 6 I have marked right nearby. There it is. Many proclaim themselves loyal, but who can find one worthy of trust again? Even with God, there are many gods that claim our worship, but who can find a God worthy of trust? Be the same thing. In my house, oh, Dana, yes.
One that's interesting coming from a king is 22. It says, fear an angry king as you would a growling lion, because making him angry is suicide.
Making him angry is suicide, especially in the days when the divine right of kings gave him the authority to do whatever he liked with people who irritated him.
Well, it's funny he put that in, just, you know, kind of like, hey, listen to that, don't make me mad.
That would point maybe also to the days when he was young and idealistic and seemed to know God very well, and then later on he forgot some of these things. When you come to the end of Ecclesiastes, he says, I wish I had remembered these things when I was young, before I made a fool of myself. So maybe he read the Proverbs near the end of his life, and it helped him repent and try to make things right. The proverb that I heard most in my house is in 24, 33 and 34. My father tended to rise very early in the morning, and he felt that everybody else in the family should enjoy the same metabolism and be as alert that early in the morning as he was. So he would come into the boy's bedroom, and with his resonant preacher's voice, he would quote this proverb. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to... Of course, he'd do the King James, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed... King James said, man, here an armed warrior? He loved to do that. I can hear him doing it right now. He's been gone for 23 years, and I hear his voice coming into our bedroom. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. And we would object from the covers as he would urge us to get up and join him out in the garden, doing something profitable. Well, many years later, and it's a good thing it was many years later, my eye lit upon 27:14, which I could have used. It says there, whoever blesses a neighbor with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. But you see, it's a good thing I didn't find it prematurely. I might have not used that with proper respect for my father. And I'm sure he would have been well able to handle the situation. So, is there something like this in Proverbs 6? I have that marked. Proverbs 6, 10 and 11. 6, 10, 11. Oh, there it is again. There it is. It's twice in there. A little folding of the hands to sleep. I can hear his very voice saying that. Connie, did you grow up with a proverb? Your dad knew them all.
Oh, yes. But, you know, it was probably a mixture of proverbs and regular.
And good wisdom. And so on. What did you think of his advice on the subject of wine running through here? It's customary in many schools that encourage temperance to have temperance oration competitions all around the country. And this is one of the favorite texts from the Bible in those orations. Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. And there's your text coming after that, Dana. The dread anger of a king is like the growling of a lion. Then they put another verse with this. They put 23:29. I've heard many temperance orations using these verses. And it's very dramatic, and it lends itself to oration. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger late over wine. Those who keep trying mixed wines. Do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. There's many an ad for liquor that speaks about going down smoothly. At the last it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I will seek another drink. And all that stuff lends itself very well to a temperance oration. And there's one other that's often put with it in 31. And these are the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. Know, my son, know, son of my womb, know, son of my vows. Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine. Or for rulers to desire strong drink. Or else they will drink and forget what has been decreed, and will pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Now that works beautifully into a temperance presentation. I have never heard the temperance orator include verse 6. But give strong drink to one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty, and remember their misery no more. And isn't that why a lot of people do drink? Mm-hmm. Because they are depressed, and they want to forget their poverty and so on. Why is it that so often the saloons are in those parts of town, in the inner city where there's poverty? I would like to hear a temperance orator speak on that one time, to be fair about it, because it might lead him to give the right approach to this subject of being disciplined and not using wine or strong drink if you have important decisions to make. Now, the king who has important decisions to make shouldn't touch it. Why not? Lest he forget. Now, of course, if you want to forget, it says below, a very good way to forget is to drink. It would suggest that the best approach to not drinking is first to reestablish a person's self-respect as an intelligent individual with power to think and make decision. And if he has learned some self-respect, that he does have the right and the ability to make up his own mind, then he too won't want to take things that would cause him to forget whatever else it is besides wine. I like the approach that's implied here. It's not an arbitrary one. There's a reason for not doing anything that would dull the mind and make it difficult to remember. What do you think of the approach? I think that the temperance oration would be stronger if it included those two. Like Hebrews 5 later on is going to say that people who are really mature are those who have their faculties trained by practice to distinguish between good and evil. That's a mind that has not been dulled in any way. So it would be best first, I think, to present that. And to remember also, for example, that on the cross, Jesus was offered vinegar and he took it. He was offered wine mixed with myrrh and he didn't take it. Now, why didn't he take it? He had very important decisions to make. Is it that the wine mixed with myrrh would in any way dull his mind? And these were the most important decisions ever made in the history of the universe. Well, it's interesting to look up the custom in those days. And here on the record it says, Rabbi Hisda, about A.D. 309, wrote, "When one is led out to execution, he is given a goblet of wine containing a grain of frankincense, or myrrh, in order to benumb his senses." That's about the only kind thing that was done to Jesus. They offered him an anesthetic to benumb his senses, and he deserved to have it. Someone going into surgery. You do this, you're an anesthesiologist, you do this very thing all the time. Do you expect the patient, as you're anesthetizing him, to make important decisions?
No.
Would you accept any decision he might speak at the time that he's going under?
No, we always tell them after surgery, if they're going home, someone needs to drive them, even if they feel like they can drive themselves. And they're not to operate any heavy machinery, and they laugh at that. But they're not to make any decisions like to sell the house or buy a new car. They're to wait till the next day.
So if Jesus had taken the wine mixed with myrrh, there should have come the instructions with it. Now, having taken this, you would not want to make any important decisions about the universe. Look at what happened after this moment that he was hung on the cross, when the devil was tempting him to doubt his father and so on. Look at the decision he came to. Never was his mind clearer than at that moment, or more necessary that it be clear. Now, to me, that approach toward not just drinking, but anything else that would benumb the mind, that's very winsome to me. It just makes good sense, which is the mood of all the Proverbs, isn't it? Does that suggest that God makes good sense? That the religion he encourages makes good sense? And I find if I'm involved in a religious activity that doesn't make good sense, I hope I will feel progressively more and more uncomfortable in that setting, or at least work on it and see if I can make sense out of it. I think that it's very appealing that Jesus set that example. Well, other things in here. Look at the insight, because one of the things I'm impressed with is we sometimes suggest that people in those days were not very sophisticated. The wisdom in these Psalms and the theology in these Proverbs, I mean, is really very insightful. Look at 21:3. To do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to God than sacrifice. We think of these people as caught up in all their rituals and ceremonies. Look at that statement. Of course, Father David had already said that in the 51st Psalm, hadn't he? Mm-hmm. And Solomon had had a chance to read that. And so he either wrote this, or when he heard this one, he said, "Ooh, I'll add that one. That's the truth. My dad would have agreed with that one for sure." Of course, the prophets had said this. Micah had said it. Hosea had said it very specifically. The Old Testament writers all said this. Then how is it that sacrifice became so dominant, ritual and ceremony, in the religion of the people who opposed Jesus? Many of them, not all of them, many of them. The truth was right there. Oh, look at 28:13 for something that's in the New Testament. I find very little in the New Testament that isn't already in the Old, incidentally. 28:13, "No one who conceals transgressions will prosper, but one who confesses and forsakes them will obtain mercy." That's in the New very much. Well, all in all, what's the effect on reading the Proverbs? With respect to our major question, what does this book tell us about God? This collection right in the middle of the Bible. What if it were left out? Would it be much of a loss? I mean, they all make good sense anyway, so we might have thought of these things just because they make sense.
It cuts to the heart of a lot of things, like in chapter 21, verse 2.
21:2.
It says, you may think that everything you do is right, but remember that the Lord judges your motives.
And yeah, mine has weighs the heart. See, the good news is a little more interpretive, but it's right on this target, isn't it? Mine, the Lord weighs the heart. Yours says the Lord judges the motives.
Mm-hmm. But you think of things like that, and you look at how the people were living back then, and by doing the sacrifices, it seems like those were markers. You know, I've done this many sacrifices, you know, as we used to check off in church, how many Bible studies did you give? How many times did you visit the poor? You can check those off, whereas your motives.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the things in here, it just...
And Jesus took up that subject of motive over and over. He said, so you've not done this, but did you want to?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's the 10th commandment. Did you want to? You didn't do it, but did you want to? Now, you could say, well, I could have thought these up myself in one of my more enlightened moments because they make such good sense. All right, let's say one could. Is it impressive that the Lord would inspire what you agree is good sense? He's put it on record in Scripture. I find that rather confirming. That they make such good sense is very confirming to me. I found myself saying, yes, I agree with that. I certainly do. And I'm not saying I believe that because you said it, though I would be willing to do that. I already believed that before I read it. That's very confirming. It means God, again, makes good sense. Any other effect? Is this the first time you've ever read them all through, Jane?
Yes.
What do you think of a collection like this?
Well, I enjoyed it. Just like Connie was saying, it makes sense and it's interesting. And you think, oh, well... I should have thought of that, to put it that way, you know, to like put in a card and give to someone you're thinking of, and, well, the nice ones, of course.
Now, that's the same idea that I was suggesting, that, yeah, I could have thought of that. It just appeals to one's reason and intelligence, isn't it? I don't know, Daniel, do you like the Proverbs?
Yeah, I thought they were the kind of things that everybody wants to be able to obey, but never really says, I'm going to do it and actually succeed.
They're very understandable. And when it says fools don't do these things, you think absolutely mm-hmm. right. And I've been a fool all too frequently. It just appeals to the reason.
It's amazing how many profound things there are just one after another.
Yeah, in such close compass. That's true. That's why I like to just slowly read through one after the other, think of each one. How about you, Bob? What do you think about this collection?
Well, what went through my mind was... how intelligent Solomon was. I'm sure you could sit on each one of these, and he had seen something or had his own life experience that had brought this about, him putting down the proverb. And there's probably a lot hanging on each one. And then to think what he went ahead and did, he transgressed a good number of these.
Yes.
I mean, he writes about adultery up one side and down the other, and yet had... 1,000 wives. Maybe he didn't consider it adultery, but in the end, it did the same thing.
Did the same
for
thing.
Most of the things he wrote about here, he went ahead to do later.
But wasn't it Nehemiah's explanation that it was all those wives that led even wise King Solomon astray? Yeah.
So just the knowledge of facts, or even the understanding of what cause and effect, isn't enough, it appears, to keep you from doing some of the stupid things yourself.
By the way, that principle of cause and effect, again, suggests there's nothing arbitrary about this, is there? And God is charged with being arbitrary and exacting and severe. This all makes good sense. And the consequences described, there's nothing arbitrary about them. This is what happens. It appeals to me tremendously. And that God would put it in the middle of the Bible appeals to me a great deal, that he's this kind of a person. So, in summary then, first of all, the people that could produce something like this, possess something like this, and circulate something like this were hardly a primitive people. I mean, this is intelligence, isn't it, all the way through? So the people God was dealing with way back in those days, this is before the Babylonian captivity, way back then, were not primitive people. The people that the prophets came to, were brilliant people. Now, we're coming to those a little later, I mean, Micah and Amos and Isaiah and Jeremiah, they were dealing with a very gifted people. Intelligent people, not primitive people. And yet look what they did later on. But then maybe most of all, I think I'm impressed with what you raised earlier, Connie, that God blessed Solomon with this much wisdom, practical, down-to-earth wisdom, and yet left him free to make a monumental fool of himself. And yet, after many years of acting so self-destructively, having been trained up in the way he should go, when he was old, it was still with him. And he came back and said, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before you get as old as I am. I wish I had. But when he came back, he said, God, is there anything I can do to keep other people from being the fool that I have been and live up to the things that I wrote when I was young? And God says, yes, write another book. And Solomon might have said, how could you ask me to write another book after all the damage I've done? And God says, well, you've really come back, haven't you? You may write another book. And if Solomon could have quoted Peter, who is yet to write many centuries later, Peter says, only holy men of God, moved by the Holy Spirit, write books in the Bible. And Solomon could have said, God, you mean you would number me among the holy men inspired by the Spirit? And God says, yes, write me another book. Write Ecclesiastes. Now, who looks good in that whole scene? Would you recommend Solomon? I'm happy he came back, but he was a fool. The one who looks incredibly good is God. And when Solomon came back, he didn't say, now you can be the janitor from now on. He said, write me another book. It's just marvelous. When David came back, he wrote at least the 51st Psalm after he came back. That God will treat us that way is most encouraging if we have not lived up to these proverbs. But happy is the child who's grown up with them. They'll stay with him, and maybe later in life, he'll remember them, and he comes back. And if he comes back, God does not take you halfway back. But as in yet to come, in the story told by Jesus of the prodigal son, when you come back, you are fully reinstated with full dignity and honor. And that's incredibly good news about God. Yes, Connie.
It's also good for God, though, because what he knows is that Solomon truly loves him with complete freedom. It wasn't a forced thing. He doesn't have a robot. He may be left, and that broke God's heart. But when he came back, it was because of the way he'd been brought up. He thought it out, and he totally loves God with complete freedom. Freedom to choose not to.
How do you like that? That really sums it up very well. That is, Solomon had shown that even though God blessed him with freedom, he was free, and regrettably, he exercised it self-destructively, and he reaped all the consequences described here, these natural consequences in the Proverbs. But yet he still had a little of the freedom left. Now, one can lose that, can't one, if one goes beyond that point of no return? He still had enough capacity left to say, I would like to come back. So this is a very good example of freedom. Now, when he came back, did he recover all the wasted years? That was gone.
Yeah.
Did he recover the energy he undoubtedly had squandered in those years? So some describe him as a tired and foolish old king. But there was enough left to come back and to write Ecclesiastes, which is the book we read next time. And once again, it's not some human being. It's always God who looks good. And we have every reason to trust a God like that.